I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
It's time for me, it's
time,
the raggedy time. Ass kid, to lead the episode.
Huh? Is Daniel Day-Lewis in There Will Be Blood just doing John Huston?
Yes. That's well reported.
And I think I've always known that, but watching this, I was like, oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Cause, and then I was trying to do John Huston, and it just comes out as Daniel Plainview.
Correct, yeah.
Because it is.
Let's go for a drive.
Don't be thick in front of me, Brooks. Brooksy.
Yeah, it's the same voice.
The future, Mr. Gitz. The future.
That's my favorite. That's not from this movie.
Correct.
But I'm just saying.
Ooh, Brandon, look at that sweatshirt. Spartan tuba.
Thank you.
Reminds me of some of the sweatshirts that Lizzie Moss wears in the film Her Smell. And I would like to just go ahead and put it on the microphone here, make sure that I'm sticking my flag on the moon now. I am officially the lead chair of the Keep Ben Impey From Ever Seeing Her Smell committee.
Uh-oh.
I'm looking for co-chairs. I'm happy
so
to...
So many people have told me I will hate
it. You're going to hate it. You will hate it.
And why Ben specifically hating it?
Well, I don't want to say because I don't want to color his expectations of the movie going in, but I will say that the vein on his temple is going to pop straight through his skin when he hears someone compare this performance to Jenna Rollins, which inevitably you will.
Here it comes.
You will.
I mean, the trailer, the like teaser clip that is released makes me want to kill myself.
I haven't seen
it. Oh, well, there you go.
I haven't seen the trailer.
Like, I think it's unwatchable.
Well, the first hour and
I'm so
25
glad that we're
minutes.
Comparing everything to Jenna Rollins.
I mean, I would compare the performance to Jenna Rollins.
Lady Gaga, and I would, Natalie Portman.
Everyone's Jenna Rollins.
Everyone is just doing Jenna Rollins.
This is okay, but at least see the movie. I'm in charge of keeping you from ever seeing the movie. What am I saying? Even if you disagree, which you will, I think you will understand that people have much more evidence with them. With this performance.
Maybe.
And comparing her to Jenna Rollins.
Oh, you mean more than Gaga? Hmm.
Yes.
Sure.
Did I compare her to Jenna Rollins on this podcast?
No.
Okay.
But that was that
people did.
That one review that leaked super early.
Oh, the one that said Bradley Cooper's vision was Kubrickian, Wellesian.
It's so stupid that that
with the
like,
emotional
got traction.
Specificity of Cassavetes or whatever.
Like, that was from, like, a blog. It was a blog called, like, Joe's House. Like, it was, like...
It was Lady Gaga's like, Uncle Joe.
Yeah, it was, like...
You sold Joe's house?
I fucking went for
it. I told you, but you were drunk.
You were fucking drunk. You were fucking drunk.
You were fucking drunk.
Those motherfucking fuckers didn't tell me.
What does he say?
Those fuckers didn't tell me a goddamn thing.
Oh, it's so good. It's so good. I can't wait.
What's going to be his Oscar clip? Just him crying.
The crying.
Yeah, the crying scene. Yeah.
They probably.
Wait, Brandon, you're not a fan of the performance either? You've let him influence you on this?
No, I always thought it was a little.
Interesting. Huh. Interesting.
When he turned around with tears in his eyes, I wasn't crying. I was giggling.
Wow.
Yeah. I giggled. I literally giggled at that moment.
I had to stifle.
God, sometimes I don't know why I sit here every week. That's so upsetting to hear. Jesus.
I didn't feel anything. I thought it was stupid.
I truly don't know what I'm doing here. That's wild to me.
It's unaffected.
Yeah. All right. Well, here, I need to go get another beer. Because if I'm going to sit through this episode, I better get fucking drunk.
Yeah. Yeah. Fuck yeah.
Yeah.
Just like Jake Hannaford.
Whenever he just takes another swig.
Mm, the drinks in this movie are so potent.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, they are
like,
potent.
They look like piss. He's just drinking warm piss.
How's everybody's week?
Terrible.
Solid. I'm having a fine week.
Good for you.
Thanks.
Just kidding. I'm thrilled.
Thank you.
Mine's somewhere in the middle. Brandon, I'm sorry you're having a bad week. I would just say, you know, always remember that your heart is God's little gun.
Thank you.
You're welcome. But yes, I love the pouring of booze into glasses when it's
clinking.
When it's dribbling down John Huston's chin. Mm.
I love. Oh. I just love the sound of ice clinking in an alcoholic beverage in a film.
Of the two times I've watched the film, the line that makes me laugh every time is when the Cybill Shepherd character goes, "Should I get you another scotch?" when she's like in like a wide shot and she's just empty and alone in the back of the frame.
Cybill Shepherd.
I just watched the doc, and I like that detail that they just like pulled her off the street.
Yeah,
like come on in.
Join us.
We're having a party.
Join us.
Like she didn't know who either of them were or something.
Mm. And it shows. It sure does. They're also rude about her on the documentary. Like, mm-hmm. such a bad actress. I'm like, she did exactly what the role required.
She's fine.
Yeah, she's great. She's fine. Yeah.
They're bringing baggage of doing multiple takes for hours.
With multiple actors. With multiple lines. They're just making it up as they go along. He's done it before.
He's just making it up as he goes along.
He's done it before. Mm-hmm. Speaking of making it up as you go along.
I wonder what Oya Kodar is doing right now.
Listening to this podcast.
Probably.
Oya? Are you there?
Hello.
Speaking of making it up as...
The other side of the Oya.
Speaking of...
I like when she called Orson Welles the wind and she found the other side of it.
You mean sex?
Sex.
Speaking of making it up as we go along,
this podcast.
Welcome to another episode.
Willkommen
to another episode of Movissimo. Movies IMO. Movissimo. We are your three fave film fags. We are here to chat about film. My name is Daniel Crook.
Brandon Kirby.
I'm Ben Empey.
This evening we are gathered in Ben's apartment. Some portions of the apartment are very dark with some big old shadows against the wall. We have some blue and red and orange strobe lights going in the corner. Ben has requested oddly from me to bring 25 dummies of Bo Burnham that I have littered across the living room. Wow. We will see what happens with those as we go on.
And Ben is
I have a damp slip on my face.
I was gonna say.
And Brandon is feeding him ice cubes.
Someone has to be wearing like the slanket. The snuggie that Orson wears on.
I get it.
Got it.
That thing.
So we are here in all of that detail.
It's me.
We're about to open up a bottle of Chivas Regal. And we're talking about Orson Welles's The Other Side of the Wind. 40 wow. years in the making. It's here. Thanks, Netflix. It's arrived. We're also going to talk about, the documentary They'll Love Me When I'm Dead, which we've all watched independently. We will also be talking about a few unplanned homework. I know, and we will also be talking about,
I also watched A Final Cut for Orson.
That's the mini documentary,
which is in like trailers and more under the actual film itself.
That is the one I'm more curious about watching.
It talks more about the restoration.
Yeah, it is about the restoration. Specific.
Which I will say I was thankful that The Love Me When I'm Dead didn't go too deep into that, only because as a Netflix-produced documentary, to then turn around and be propaganda towards Netflix being the savior of film would just be a little grating. And
it's really just about Frank Marshall being the savior of film.
I'm into that. We're also talking about a couple unwieldy auteur pictures. We're talking about Francis Ford Coppola's Apocalypse Now, and we're talking about Elaine May's Ishtar. We are not going to be talking about, as planned, Michael Cimino's Heaven's Gate, so apologies to the two people who watched that in preparation for this. We will Venmo you $4
this
one for every hour.
We did say last week we were going to talk about it.
We did.
So apologies. I
do want to put on the record that we have accidentally taken sides in the storied, tumultuous fight of the Isabels. We have come down on the side of a Johnny over Uper.
Oh, wow.
By omitting
You're right.
Heaven's Gate. Uh-oh. I just want to make sure that we're all aware of that.
Oh, no.
And taking that into the conversation.
You're right. That's okay.
It's fine. I mean, I was the one who recommended we watch Heaven's Gate. And
Ishtar is at least not boring.
No. And I was the one who recommended we take it off the syllabus.
There's a lot to... I did watch an hour...
Much to discuss on the show.
70 minutes of Heaven's Gate before I was just like, it's a Saturday night and I can't do this anymore.
Oh, I'm sorry.
that is a mood. It is Saturday night and I can't do this anymore.
I mean, that's
me at Akbar.
It's a mood before you even get to that. It's Saturday night and I'm staying in to watch Heaven's Gate.
Yeah. I skipped Her Smell. to stay home and watch.
And thank God for that.
Heaven's Gate.
So Michael Cimino is the honorary co-chair of the committee.
There are things to discuss. I just don't know why it's not a two-hour movie.
Isn't that part of the story?
Is it really 5.5 hours?
Well, that might be the director's cut.
There is a version that's not the version that I was watching. Mine was like Jean Dielman.
I mean, here's the thing. If you're going to single-handedly...
No, it's 3 hours, 40 minutes longer than Jean Dielman.
If you're going to torpedo the New Hollywood with excess, it takes a lot of excess to out-excess the New Hollywood.
Yeah.
Of course, this is after Jaws. This is after...
Star Wars. In like... postmodern territory.
Right, but
I'm not saying it is a postmodern.
I'm just saying in the lore, we can talk about how we're looking at film in terms of shifting away.
Deer Hunter.
Correct. But which Cimino also directed.
Follow-up to The Deer Hunter.
But that's sort of part of it, right? Like Cimino does The Deer Hunter and then it
invented the screener with The Deer Hunter.
Oh.
Did you know that?
Didn't know that.
I didn't know that.
There used to be in LA Channel Z. Just free on the airwaves.
Great B-52 song.
And everyone at Universal was like, we have this awful, sad, long movie about the Vietnam War. No one's going to watch it. Let's throw it on Channel Z for a full month on a loop at all times. Tell everyone in the Academy that it's there. And then release it in theaters and then won all the Oscars. And it made a shitload of money.
And then he releases Heaven's Gate and squanders all of the hope and potential that the Deer Hunter, the cachet that he spends all of the cachet that the Deer Hunter.
And then everyone else is like, oh, we can send people movies in their home and they'll watch it there. Oh.
And next thing you know, Chocolat is
and
the
then
best picture.
Here we are. Here we are 40 years later and Green Book is going to win Best Picture because it's an easy sit at home.
This is literally the new like criteria, like an easy sit at home, Best Picture.
Which is the
I watched Three Billboards for the second time at home, and it was I was kind of like, oh, I get it. Like if you watch it at home, I can see like jiving with this
because you're just like energy. Noodling on your couch.
Yeah. The punishing irony is that the likeliest friendship is between an Academy voter and their couch.
You're right. Whereas when we saw Three Billboards,
it was 10
in a
p.m.
theater. I wanted to
you guys
claw
went at 10 p.m.
my face
it was
out.
10 p.m.
I went at like 1:30 p.m. and on a Saturday.
I wanted to
Dakota Johnson rip my chest open,
which is what my boot looks like right now on the sole. The sole is split open. Looks like the chest cavity. The boot that I'm wearing, my shoe.
Oh,
my shoe.
My shoe, Al. My shoe.
What?
I don't know.
I was going to say that as well. That's exactly where my mind went.
Ow. Brooksy.
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 Okay, shut up.
So The Other Side of the Wind, you know, this is, I don't know if you've heard about the behind-the-scenes story, the production history of this thing.
I heard it's pretty wild.
It's pretty wild. It's pretty, it's storied, it's complicated.
It's
quite substantial. It's, you know what? It's layered. It's dark. It's interesting. It's complicated.
Very interesting.
I love interesting movies.
Orson Welles is shooting. His new movie starts in 1971, shooting through, 1976? Mm-hmm. Off and on. Cast members are bopping in and out. I'm sure we're going to touch on this production history as we talk about this, so I'm not going to go through all of it. The footage ends up being seized by the Shah of Iran, or the Ayatollah of Iran, rather. Right. Movie was never finished. It was supposed to be the big masterpiece. And Frank Marshall, Peter Bogdanovich, and Netflix all came together, put their rings in the middle, touched them.
And out came
The Other Side of the Wind. So the film takes place on the 70th birthday of legendary director Jake Hannaford. He is in the middle of shooting his new film, also called The Other Side of the Wind. It's a little bit of a departure from the types of Hollywood films he's been making. This one is a little bit more of a Antonioni riff. So basically the movie takes place. Jake has compiled a who's who of the new Hollywood, of critics, of longtime friends, collaborators, notably none of the lead actors who he has catapulted to fame.
Oh.
And they all go to Jake's desert manse. They go to Jake's desert manse. And they have a party. Secrets are revealed. Allegiances are broken. Ultimately, we're talking a lot about movies. talking a lot about friendship.
Movies IMO.
Talking a lot about formative faggotry. I'll put it on the record.
Formative faggotry.
I'll put it on the record right now with all due respect to our friend who is releasing this movie. But I saw Knife and Heart with Ben at AFI Fest, which I loved. And then I saw The Other Side of the Wind on the same night. Other Side of the Wind is gayer than Knife and Heart. I'm putting it on the record. Yeah. That's
is
my
it
take.
Knife and Heart? Okay.
Is this a gay movie?
Watching the other,
the other side of the wind is a gay movie.
Watching The Other Side of the Wind for a second time when I'm not lost at all and what everybody's talking about, I know Ayn Rand posed the question, who is John Dale? I figured it out on the first viewing. Second time around, all anybody is talking about
is that he's gay.
Is that he's gay.
And I didn't notice that the first time. I didn't. It's a lot...
To the
I
point where
it was very layered.
To the point where, like, I did too. And then watching it again, I'm like, this is what this is the only dramatic heft to the movie.
Yeah, is watching it at home with subtitles on. I was like, oh, they're just every single line is, oh, did you know he's gay?
Yes,
yeah.
As it is all closing in on him. I mean, this movie descends into this sort of melancholy chaos.
Yeah,
and part of it, and I don't think that Jake's main motivation in the film is that he's trying to shield his homosexuality, but there's an element of like running away from himself, his past, and his homosexuality.
Yeah.
And yeah, watching it again, like all anyone talks about, like whether they're in the bus on the way over, whether it's like his DP or whatever, who's holding up a fucking iron pipe saying, give this to Jake, he'll feel a lot better after he uses it. Mm. Not even in a hateful way, even though that's like a hate crime.
Yeah.
It's just everyone knows, it's assumed. Mm. And I feel like Jake knows that everyone knows this, but is still never going to confirm it. Like the way he toys with the English teacher from John Dale's preparatory school, he knows how he's coming off, and he has associates in the room.
Yeah,
I mean, I think he enjoys like walking right up to the line and then crossing it, and then making fun of you, pouring a scotch, and exiting the room.
Laughter.
Anyway, so that's what The Other Side of the Wind is about, right?
That was the best synopsis we've had on this program.
I know.
Other Side of the Wind is. Directed by Orson Welles, written by Orson Welles and Oya Kodar.
Oh yeah, I forgot they co-wrote it.
Yes,
they were lovers.
They were lovers. Correct. For what, 25 years?
Mm-hmm. And John Huston. And John Huston is like watching my essentially my
wife,
stepmother, watching the beads bounce against her breasts.
Right.
In the film, within a film, was a moment of, you know, not formative faggotry, but like hard won heterosexuality or something. Which is kind of, you know, interesting. Dark.
You know.
Complicated.
It's very interesting.
Let's chat about the film.
Let's start.
Where would you like to begin, Ben?
With.
Ben is back.
The some word. Say he never left.
Cell phone.
In the introduction.
Which
so what you're.
Threw me.
What Ben is referring
Wait,
to isn't... So the other thing about The Other Side of the Wind is that it is technically... It's a mockumentary. You get so lost in the drama of it, you forget. But it opens with, you know, stills of Jake Hannaford, his crashed car, and Peter Bogdanovich as Brooks Otterlake, his protege, a version of himself, is setting the scene and essentially explaining why... There are so many cameras there and how all of this footage was compiled. Mm-hmm. And Ben.
There is a voiceover and Peter Bogdanovich talks about this was before people had cell phones at parties or whatever. And I was like, oh, that's so weird because
how
everyone has a 16 millimeter camera.
Yeah. It's talked about in the other documentary that there was a voiceover that was supposed to be from John Huston. And Peter Bogdanovich was like, I will just rewrite it in my character, and I will do it. And they updated it.
Oh, yeah, because cell phone.
Mm-hmm.
Cell phone.
Cell phone.
Mobile phone.
And it like, threw me for a second.
Yeah,
I was
that's...
like, oh, what is this movie? What is this magical film? Oh. I didn't know.
Yeah.
And then you just get dropped into the eye of the storm.
Mm-hmm.
And
you're the first, like, 6 minutes are the most...
thrilling, manic,
like
it
discombobulating.
Takes insane. You get on its level pretty quick.
Yeah,
it forces you to. This movie has such a contemporary sensibility in the editing and in the pace.
It's very fresh.
It's extremely
very fresh.
Fresh,
what word did
fresh
say?
Never frenetic. Been done before.
Frenetic.
Oh, big time. Definitely frenetic.
Big time frenetic.
Big time.
Oh, baby. Big time frenetic. I have been trying not.
I don't even know how you conceive of how to shoot that. This is, I want to throw something because it frustrates me.
Well, there's an element.
In a good way. There's just so much footage.
Yeah, there's that. There's
so many cameras running.
Yeah, and no one is ever in a shot together. So he's able to pick up, you know, Mercedes McCambridge's entrance over here, and like in one shot, and then Norman Foster's in another, and they can be talking to each other without ever having to be in the same place. And as a result, just like that disconnect adds to the frenzy. But to your point, Brandon, like you just have this wealth of shots to choose from. But I'm dying to know which, maybe you do know this, Ben, since you watched the documentary about the assemblage of the film, but I want to see the assembly, and I want to know which scenes Orson had gone into, and I want to know if there were storyboards, because the pace of this thing and just the shot length and just the mania that is fueling through the entire thing, with the way that it's set up in the first 6 or 7 minutes, that doesn't, and I've seen F for Fake, Citizen Kane, Touch of Evil. I think that's all I've seen with Wells. So I can't really speak to pacing. And obviously with the first film, or, you know, with Citizen Kane, Touch of Evil, obviously this is would be much later.
Yeah.
Wells, but I don't know from those two. No, F for
Touch
Fake, of course.
Touch of Evil is for
now. Oh, and then F for, what am I saying? F for Fake has a very similar editing style.
Because you shot it at the same time.
Right.
They were concurrent.
Yes. And there's something, you know, if you want to look at...
He really pushed himself editing-wise as he went on, I think. Because in the beginning, it was all the deep focus, the long takes, and I feel like...
The deep focus is still... I mean, it's not deep focus, but he's using the backs of his shots.
Yeah.
The entire depth of the frame really beautifully in this film.
And I just think... I almost feel like there was a point where he was like, I'm a theater man, and I'm insecure about this, so I'm going to, like, go for it in the next one. Mm-hmm. And that is... I mean, I have no reason to think that that's what he thought, but I do think that.
Yeah. There's something about... I mean, and this is something you get from Citizen Kane, obviously, and then F for Fake, just with the wealth of distractions that you're being given and the narratives upon narratives. But if you look at you know, cinema as a magic trick, your eyes looking over here and you're not seeing this over here, but in F for Fake and The Other Side of the Wind, he's giving you 10,000 different things to look at, and there's something...
Oh, the monkey in F for Fake.
Me.
I should have watched F for Fake.
It's 80 minutes. Watch it right now. We'll take a break. Right.
I would like to rewatch F for Fake after watching this, because it's a film that I really enjoyed, but I did not like the last 20 minutes very much. But I also...
It devastates me.
Yeah. It didn't for me.
To
but,
my core.
But not because I'm right about it, because I watched it in the afternoon, you know, right before, the weekend before Outfest started last year. So I was not... And it was hot and didn't have air conditioning.
I thought you saw it in college.
F for Fake?
Oh. I thought we talked about that.
No.
Maybe that was someone else.
Who
Not
was
Brandon.
It? Ben.
Because
I haven't seen
it. You haven't seen it.
Show.
I love Orson Welles.
F for Fake.
I love him. He's the father I never had, the sister I've always wanted, I don't know a better person that gives.
And you're his raggedy ass kid.
Daddy.
That line was delivered to Orson, not to John Huston.
What did I do wrong, Daddy?
What did I do wrong, Daddy?
Really?
It's brutal. Love that. This is a movie about itself as it's being made about itself. Does that make sense?
It Absolutely. Does.
I don't
it
know
does.
How, like...
I know what you mean.
He's making it up as he goes along because it's what they're living through.
He's done it before.
And it's the crazy... Yeah. Like, I can't even wrap my head around...
The movie was writing itself as it was
being filmed. I can't imagine... Shooting the movie with someone else in the Peter Bogdanovich role and asking Peter Bogdanovich to play himself halfway through the movie.
It's such a devastating blow, in a way, to not just give him the role
in
up
the first
front
place.
And to give him that little reporter role, and then only after like the first choice didn't work out, he's like, oh, do you want to do this? He's like, I've been doing it while we've been making this movie the entire time. Like, how dare you not give me this job? Why are you making me interview for this?
Peter.
Daddy.
Ben, I would love for you to just, since you've seen the most Orson Welles here and you have the biggest connection to him, I would love for you to talk a little bit about why you love your daddy, Orson.
Why do you love daddy? Daddy.
So, I feel like it's very cool to shit on Citizen Kane, but I would like to talk about...
Says who?
Who's doing that?
People who want to be cool. I think people do.
They're not.
Ben, are you just, I mean, you can't, talking about the kids? Talking about the youth? What are you doing here?
Everyone.
The youth.
I feel like it has. We've come back around, like, in the light of Vertigo taking number one at Sight and Sound. We're back to, oh, no, it is great.
I've never considered it cool to stake the claim that Citizen Kane is overrated. Because there's a reason why it has long time been the universally agreed upon best movie of all time. And it's not just because it invented so many things with deep focus and that beautiful Rashomon structure. Mm-hmm. Like, it's just an extremely compelling film, and it's beautiful to look at, and it's devastating to feel. And the characters are brilliantly sketched by a bunch of fantastic actors.
I find it profoundly moving. I find all of his movies profoundly moving. And
the psychological portrait of Citizen Kane is as potent as anything you'll see. Like, I don't know. I just anyone who's trying to be cool by saying that Citizen Kane is overrated, maybe that is how you feel, but it is not cool.
You're not cool.
You're not cool. It's not a personality to dislike Citizen Kane. Anyway, it was, I don't know. I watched it, like, my entry point into cinephilia was the AFI Top 100 list.
Just like Carmela Soprano.
Oh my God, you're right. But I was 12.
I had a printout of the AFI list as well. Yeah. I know I mentioned that I had the Empire list. I worked off that and then the AFI list. So I'm with you on that.
I'm already mythologizing this as part of my life, that I've written about this, that there was a week, like, my sister was on a trip with friends and I was home alone and I rented movies, and the movies I rented were Citizen Kane, Casablanca, Annie Hall, Some Like It Hot, Sunset Boulevard, and All About Eve. And, like, these are the movies that have defined my life.
That's interesting.
And Citizen Kane, I just love that it's a brutal condemnation of capitalism, as are all of his movies.
In saying that capitalism has an inevitable
emptiness.
Yes, but of course, but more so that it inherently corrupts.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And what I love the most about Citizen Kane is the moment when Susan Alexander is leaving Kane and he yells, "You can't do this to me." And she walks up to him and she smiles and she says, "Oh, I'm doing this to you, am I?" Because she's a woman in his story, but she's actually not. And I love that. And then she walks out of the movie forever. Mm. It's beautiful. I don't know that anyone else in that generation would do that. Yeah. And it reminds me of Lady from Shanghai. There are the ends in Chinatown. And it's very weird to see a movie shot in the 40s that's surrounded by Chinese people. It's very strange. And I just think he has a sensitivity.
A Hollywood movie.
Yes, a Hollywood movie from the 40s with that, like, Hollywood sensibility, just like, oh, right, there are non-white people alive that could have been in all of these movies. It's very, it changes a lot of how I think about movies. Mm-hmm. And that's just true of all of Orson.
Yeah.
Thank you.
That was beautiful.
I also love in Touch of Evil that marijuana is believed to be like heroin.
Yes.
They drug Janet Leigh with marijuana.
Hell yeah.
They find Janet Leigh like in a basement with one of those giant tubs of cheese balls.
She's been drugged.
Yeah. Mm. She's off her rocker. Mm. She's got the orange fingers.
Orson. Shall we whip out the Orson Welles biography? Should I read
it? Yeah, let's whip it out and dramatically
read the entire
book. Drop it on the table.
Here I am. I don't know where it is. Oh, there. It's all the way over there. I can't reach it without getting up, and I'm not going to do that. It's behind.
You're lying.
It's there. I saw it.
Is that a copy of A Confederacy of Dunces?
Yeah.
Oh, interesting. I'm reading that
now. I've never read it, but I have it to show that I'm a good liberal.
Hell yeah. Okay, so
on the shelf.
I swear to God, this
on the shelf.
We're going to talk about The Other Side of the Wind now. I mean,
the other side of the wind.
The wind.
The other side of the wind.
I keep trying.
I'm still working on the front part, sweetie.
I kept trying to come up with like a Too Fast, Too Furious joke for me watching it the second time, but I couldn't crack it.
Two wind, two side.
Yeah, other. I couldn't do it. I couldn't get it. I couldn't get there.
You can't get there. Ben, do you just love this movie because he shits on Antonioni?
Oh, I do love that.
What I like about the film within the film.
It's a real steamy dump.
Jesus. It's a family podcast. What I like about the mocking of Antonioni style in the film within the film is that the images he produces are beautiful.
Yeah.
He's showing how easy it is to do that.
Yeah.
To shoot actors through windows with mirrors, to have images overlay around on top of one another, to have open space, like walking around. The images are gorgeous. Uh-huh. And there's a couple sequences you could touch to that are just brilliantly staged. There's a couple images I can't get out of my head, mm-hmm. specifically in the scene that John Dale walks off of the set. Because bad sentence, but he's on the
springs.
He's on the coils of the spring bed,
yeah.
And Oya Kotter is above him with her scissors, and she snips her necklace, and the pearls just come rushing out from under the bed. Mm-hmm. I find it absolutely transcendently beautiful, but also like when you're watching it, and you're trying to put some sort of story together,
yeah.
And there is no story, and that's not necessarily like. What's difficult about just totally mocking Antonioni when discussing this is that it is still a Hannaford picture, and the way that Billy is making excuses for it,
right?
He's using the logic of Hannaford's previous films, like especially around like he's making it up as he goes along, or that to me is less damning of Antonioni than the scene later at the drive-in when one of the characters goes up and says that they've got the reels mixed up,
yeah.
and the projectionist says, "Does it matter?" Like that to me is a little more damning in that moment. But that's
very rude.
Yeah,
I think.
But the way that Wells is using color, though, even though he is mocking Antonioni, it's absolutely stunning. And again, I don't mean to say like anyone could do it.
Yeah.
Because like anyone with any talent as a filmmaker could do what you're doing.
Right.
And I'm going to do it a little bit better. Having only seen Red Desert, so I haven't even seen Blow Up, so I can't really speak to too much about the.
As I was watching it the second time, the I emptiness. Was like. Antonioni would never do a Dutch angle like that. Like, it is still so much an Orson Welles
touch of evil
version of this.
And the mirrors go back to Kane.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
So he's employing similar objects and surfaces as he has in previous.
And Bogdanovich talks about, I don't know, I listened to a bunch of podcasts with Peter Bogdanovich and Frank Marshall, so I can't remember where I heard any of these things yet anymore. But Bogdanovich talked about how because he was doing a Jake Hannaford movie. He was doing a Jake Hannaford. So he was free to just go all out. And he didn't. There was something that he enjoyed about it because
it wasn't.
He's getting to slip in. He's slipping into someone else's
Orson,
skin.
Yeah, it wasn't an Orson picture.
He's doing the Lee Israel thing.
Yes.
You know?
Right.
And so he really enjoyed getting into this. Like a European art film.
One of my favorite scenes from the European art film within a film is with all the bands of shadow and light. Remember that?
Oh, absolutely.
Where they're like playing when they're, like, when weird
they're
hide
naked,
and seek.
They're naked running doing around. Cat and mouse.
Yeah.
I like when I she like has a doll scene. And she puts her finger in to make a penis and she's going to snip it off.
Snip, yes. snip off your penis.
Snip that penis.
I just love that the narrative thrust of The Other Side of the Wind, the film within a film, is just.
He has a package.
Man chases woman.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Isn't it deep and rich and layered and complicated? And
she's got a package. What's in the package?
The isolation of it. You know, it's just so existential. Mm-hmm.
Someone on Twitter said, if it's misogynist just to show a woman walking around naked in a movie, then we should just throw in the towel now because that's every movie. Yes.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Correct.
Apparently people have said that about this movie.
Seriously?
Just crazy.
I got to be honest. I'm not at all interested in what people are saying about this movie.
What the people have to say.
If it's negative or if it's like grasping for something like that. I mean, you could have a whole conversation about the use of certain words throughout this film.
Yeah.
I think it shows that it's more of its time. But I also don't think that Orson Welles wants you to like Hannaford.
No.
Or any of the characters. I mean, they're
or
all just
think it's a good movie.
Yeah.
That he's making.
No, but I mean not the film within the film.
Right.
The main text.
Right.
I think everyone is fairly despicable by design. I mean, this is a damning portrait of not just Hollywood movie making, but movie lovers in general as sick, deranged,
their
angry
world
people.
Their worldview is not upheld.
Right.
Is the thing.
Right.
Yeah.
Something I think is interesting is the response that this movie is getting from people that do love it. I am now, I get how Citizen Kane so quickly became the greatest movie of all time. You know what I mean?
Well, it's never been done before.
talented, brilliant, never the same original.
Unafraid to reference. Unafraid to
reference
or
not reference.
Shit on it. Eat it.
It. I don't know. My life changed when Peter Bogdanovich said, "What did I do wrong, Daddy?" Like, truly, like, I've never.
It's.
My life changed in that moment. I don't know.
It's one of the best moments of the year.
I don't know how to say it other than I felt a paradigm shift in my soul when
he said that. Because I'm dying to actually grapple with this thing a little bit more directly. Why don't we talk about the relationship between Jake and Brooks?
Okay.
As an analog for Orson and Peter Bogdanovich, as something else, all leading up to "What did I do wrong, Daddy?" Just like some of the layers in the relationship there. And I guess I'll explain. So anyone who doesn't know, Peter Bogdanovich.
This movie's on Netflix. You have no excuse to not watch it before you listen to this podcast.
Absolutely. Watch The Love Me When I'm Dead as well. Not necessarily because it's a great documentary.
I thought it was pretty good.
It's good. I mean,
it's entertaining.
I mean, I did not watch it for artistic.
Neither did I. And
you watch it for the inside scoop.
Yeah. I was just watching it for all the Orson B-roll.
Hell yeah.
Hell yeah.
That's true as well.
It's my baby. He's my big pink lobster.
I think we can all assume that Orson Welles sucked a dick in his life.
Absolutely.
Numerous.
In the same way that Tom Hardy has.
He's definitely a bisexual man.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, let's not label him. He's definitely had sex with men and women in his life.
Absolutely. Correct. Fluid.
He had a
voracious appetite.
Yeah.
Fluidity.
For flesh? That's it.
For the bus and the puss.
Jesus Christ.
That's not okay. All right, so Peter Bogdanovich.
You heard it here first, folks. Orson Welles had a knack for the puss and the bus.
Oh my God.
I just saw a spinning 1940s newspaper headline.
Like in Citizen Kane.
Yeah, the newsreel at the top of Citizen Kane.
News of the world. Orson Welles enjoyed the puss and the bus.
Puss and bus.
And that's Germany on the move.
Oh, I wish I hadn't said that now.
Well, it's too late.
But I'm glad I did.
Now all three of us have said it. Yeah. So. All right. I won't make this broad. I'll be very specific. I want to talk about penis envy. And I want to talk about how Jake feels about Brooks's money.
Mm-hmm.
And his recent acclaim.
Edible complex. It's an edible in a way.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's like reverse edible because we're seeing it from the
I guess penis envy is the wrong term anyway, because that's more about women towards men, right? Mm-hmm. Isn't that the concept? But I'm going to use it in this anyway.
Yeah, it makes sense, yeah.
And an edible complex.
Mm-hmm.
I really love the scene. Well, oh God, this is what I get for trying to jump into the movie. So I enjoy the moment when Jake is talking with a couple of his advisors and they're talking about Brooks's money and someone says to him, like, why don't you just ask him for it? And he's like, it's not what we do. Like, it's not the code. And then the next scene, or who can say in this movie, a few scenes after between him and Brooks, when Brooks is like, you know, everybody was talking about like my $40 million. Like, I don't necessarily have that. And so Brooks, who wants to have the impression of being daddy's favorite son who would do anything for him, realizes that he doesn't want to put his money where his mouth is, that his allegiance might not be that strong. But when he's
like everyone saying they want to say Filmstruck.
Oh yeah.
Sure.
I mean,
sure.
Cough up the money, bitch.
Actually, we don't know that Warner Brothers isn't just like, no thank you, because we're doing a Netflix play.
When you're getting into the contradictions and the desperation of Jake Hannaford, when Brooks says that he doesn't have all that money, but like, do you need some?
Mm-hmm.
And after Jake has said, we don't ask fellow directors for money. We don't ask fellow men for money. He's like, how much have you got? Like, how much can you give? Just show, like, he's a broken man, but there's also the question of how together he was in the first place. And if these moral codes are more about showmanship than actual virtue, I find very compelling.
When Brooksy asks him, how many times have you been broke? And Hanford says, just once. Do you think he means the whole time? Or do you think he is joke? Like, it can be read two ways. He's joking that, of course, he's been broke a few times, / the whole time I've been broke.
I think that's an interesting read, and I think that's, I mean, whether or not that's what Orson Welles meant by the line, and he may have. Yeah, for sure. I mean, he's probably always been working from some sort of a deficit, like certainly spiritually.
Mm-hmm. I love the conversation between the two young people where one's like, well, you could make one great big movie and then you're like set for a while and you can make what you want. And the other person is like, well, what about people who don't want to make that one movie? Like, don't they deserve the same amount?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's very
important
distinction.
It's never spoken directly if Jake Hannaford reinvented movies and then spent some time in exile or was having to fight Hollywood to be taken seriously. Mm-hmm. I don't think that in that way he's a Welles analog.
Right.
But I do, and I don't know why I'm going in this direction because it has nothing to do with being a Welles analog, but to the line that you're bringing up, Ben, about being broke one time, I think he's certainly in the most dire straits that he's been in at this moment.
Right.
And there's something very sad about Hannaford making the Antonioni movie because he's not doing it in the same way that Welles is shooting The Other Side of the Wind in order to mock it. There's an idea that Hannaford might be making this movie out of...
He's trying to appeal to the youth.
And there are multiple times in the movie when people are like, it's what the kids are... It's Billy, who is my favorite character in the movie. And
which one is that?
Billy is the former child actor who now is like his assistant.
Oh, yeah.
Is he the one eating milk duds?
He's the one eating eating gumdrops.
I love his voice.
I do too. I love that how that aw-shucks mentality is just broken down as the movie goes on. But where was it going with this? And I don't remember. But
I
don't remember.
Just
love it.
Sybil Shepherd. Fake Sybil Shepherd.
All right.
A Sybil Shepherd type.
I'll write you a note.
I'll write you a note to your teacher.
He was gonna cuckold Peter Bogdanovich, but not really because he's a faggot.
But there's the line he would do it for the revenge. No, there's the Susan Strasberg character has the moment where she talks about how he would sleep with all of his leading men's wives. It's the idea of if I can't have you, I'm going to get as close to you as I can, and I'm going to insert myself into your bedroom and upend your life.
Mm-hmm.
I love the scene between Jake and the English teacher from John Dale's preparatory school.
Mm-hmm.
When, I mean, how they're just like dancing around. And also just the idea of John Dale's backstory, like whether or not Jake found him, like plucked him from obscurity, plucked him from a beach somewhere, but actually he's this like rich kid. But there's the moment that I find so heartbreaking is when the teacher says that John went to Acapulco specifically to meet Jake. And Jake didn't know that. Mm-hmm. Like, you can see in John Huston's face, like, he falls in love in that moment, in that close-up. And that's just when he starts, like, laughing uncontrollably and asking more follow-up questions. And I believe it's pretty soon after that when he says, faggot.
Yep.
And that scene is just heartbreaking to me. Yeah. It's funny. It's dark. It's complicated. It's layered. It's interesting.
It's so interesting.
It's just really, really rich and really interesting. Rich and interesting.
I'll finish up my point then. There's just something about the ritual humiliation that comes along with homosocial hierarchy with men. And there's that great moment at the end of that scene when Jake suggests that they all go swimming. And the English teacher's like, oh, what a delightful proposition.
What will I wear?
Yeah. And then Jake gets up and goes behind the bar with Bogdanovich and a couple other people. And then it's just this humiliating, wonderfully embarrassing shot where the English, it's like a wide, and the English teacher's in the middle all alone, and it's a point of view shot.
Oh, yeah.
But then the reverse is just these four guys around the bar just like mocking him and laughing at him.
Take your clothes off now.
Exactly, trying to get him to strip down. I mean, it feels very...
It's frat boy.
It's very frat boy, yeah. It feels even more so like teenage boys, like at an all-boys school or something. Yeah.
Which is right after
we find out that John Dale, like, I heard that. I heard that. I'm going right past it.
God damn it.
This episode is turning into The Other Side of the Wind.
Very meta.
I was going to say something.
Well.
What do you have to say, Brandon?
I just am listening to you two for this one.
What did you like about it?
I should have compiled more thoughts.
That's why I started
we both watched it twice. The reason I watched it a second time was because I knew I wasn't going to be able to talk look about at my it. Notes
I only just like started it. Grappling really with it until today when I watched the doc, and then started like really, really appreciating it because I appreciated it that it existed the first time I watched it, and then it really I couldn't stop thinking about it, and then I like was like dropping through it a little bit, and then I watched the doc, and I mean I love shit that's like super meta, and I love that this was the filmmaking was updating in real time as the movie's made. It's just an incredible document of and it's the most we've heard about Orson in a long time. It's like the most he's been the Love Me When I'm Dead, just like the doc title, like I mean, hasn't it been a minute since he's been in the conversation?
The he's sort of like always in the film culture conversation, but I will say, and I know that there are other people that feel this way, like I haven't felt the call to finally watch all those Wells movies I never got around to until the past couple
and
of months.
It's just insane to me that it's Netflix. That really is like the cherry on top of all the meta-ness of the whole thing.
Because
is that it's Netflix.
He finally didn't get money or distribution from a studio.
No, he got it from a quote-unquote maverick.
Netflix.
Outside the studio system.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
Which is in the new studio system.
And, you know, it's called the chain of title. All of the, like, rights and the various sources of where they needed to get people to sign off and all of that. Like, every other studio is so intimidated by it, but Netflix
was like, let's do it.
Yeah. Netflix was like, let's go for it.
I mean, why not? It builds them a tremendous amount of goodwill between people like us.
I mean, it's just...
And these are the important people you want to get on your side, let's be honest.
Orson. I mean, Netflix is having...
Yeah.
Netflix is having, like, a hell of a year. They have, like, the movie that you can't have year-end lists without talking about. Mm-hmm. And then they have...
And then there's the other
the
side of the wind. Because Roma... I mean, yes, exactly.
Yeah, but, like...
Roma.
I mean, both. But, yeah. And then they have probably the Best Picture winner. Yeah.
I will...
They have a cultural... film moment, and then the Best Picture winner.
Yeah, which Roma is in and of itself another huge cultural moment. But yes, it's touching on two... We're talking about film history and film preservation and then the future of film at the same time. It's really brazen in a way that I admire, the way that they're going after this. And specifically with the Best Picture Oscar for Roma. So I saw it at the AFI Fest premiere, the LA premiere or whatever, and Netflix bought popcorn for everybody in the audience.
Yeah.
And I should have brought it in to show you guys, but in...
They want to win.
In paper popcorn boxes that had the Roma poster on both sides.
Fuck,
and apparently they did it for a Ballad of Buster Scruggs a couple nights later as well. And they also bought everybody free soda, but I had just had a coffee, so I was good.
I love that.
Yeah, they're going for it.
They are really...
I mean, they are bringing the screening luncheons to the festival.
Yeah.
At this point, with
the
free
popcorn.
I mean,
there was that one Roma screening that was like literally a luncheon
before...
Oh, right.
That they were like serving like John and Vinny's before the screening.
I can't imagine like eating and probably drinking wine before watching that movie for the first time.
No. Gotta go in dry, baby.
Gotta go in dry. Gotta go in hungry.
I went in wet because it was raining and we had to stand in line.
Oh, I was just about to lean in and be like,
oh, that's good.
Oh.
Going in wet. Like raining in the other side of the wind.
Oh, like that sex
scene. In the car
scene.
And the sex scene in the car.
The sex scene. The sexiest sex scene. So I think it's a really interesting... I think it's really interesting.
What's interesting?
That
ben?
This movie...
Derek, complicated.
And the movie within the movie is an illustration of the way that filmmakers, male filmmakers for 150 years or whatever, I can't tell time anymore,
it's
130 real. 20
it's because all our clocks are in the house with the clock
in
its walls.
All of my clocks are on my walls.
Can we go back and do an episode on that?
reversing
that the way that they exert dominance, not just through what the content of the film is, but the way that the film is being made, like the way that we hear Jake Hannaford over the scene of John Dale leaving and like that sex scene that leads into it, like the just cut the thing and follow him.
Yeah, that I'm glad you touched on that moment when he's like, I'm not going to do it in the John Huston voice. I don't remember exactly what he says, but like, get this, keep it because we will need this for the myth.
Yes.
Like and also there's something about the way that he is watching John Dale storm off the set that is humiliating for John, mm-hmm. and Jake is capturing it and furthering that embarrassment and humiliation. Mm-hmm. And that domination that you're talking about, which is of course, it's not just heterosexual, it's just masculine, right? Mm-hmm. The way that masculinity draws blood intentionally plays out in innumerable ways throughout the party as well. Right. Whether it's intellectual superiority, whether it's physical superiority.
When he's like, someone should write that down.
Yes.
When he knows fully well that it is a quote.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. I mean, and that's what I love so much about Susan Strasberg and Mercedes McCambridge. Mm-hmm. And then also Lily Palmer, who plays Zara Valeska, the host. Mm-hmm. Valeska is the one who's constantly being like, cut the shit out. This is all on camera. Like, can we please just chill the fuck out?
Yeah.
Mercedes McCambridge has just resigned herself to it, but she has that great line about, what's the line she says? Wrote it down. Oh, have a go at the dummies, Jake. They break even more easily than people. Like, they are seeing what's going on for the pageantry of masochism that it is.
Right.
And then, of course, Susan Strasberg, who's just having the time of her life, because she knows that everyone will give her what she wants. I mean, she doesn't drink throughout the entire party. She is just permanently smoking and marching through the crowds asking questions, because she knows that every man there is dying to one-up the next, and not just in terms of dirt and not just in terms of a witticism, but in order to be shown to have the most to say. And there's those great scenes with Peter Bogdanovich and then the other imitation Hannaford when they're kind of going back and forth about who has like ripped him off more or who which of them is more indebted to him. And it's all fascinating from a film journalist point of view, just to tell the story of these people and to get at the meat of who they are and how that informs their filmmaking.
Yeah.
And that's ultimately what she's trying to do during the party. She's on a quest to nail down Hannaford's homosexuality.
When someone's like, he's going to score tonight. And she's like, well, if we're going to talk about who he scores with, that's an interesting conversation. She's like,
now that's where things get interesting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm. She's like, let's talk about that. Yeah. She's like, come to me.
Can we just go through some favorite shots in the film?
Oh, fuck yeah.
I'll go first. The birthday cake sequence. Scene. It's not a sequence. Not just the shot of John Huston about to blow out all the candles where the foreground of the frame. And this is where, like, again, it's not deep focus, but where Wells is really playing with the depth of his frames. Mm-hmm. You've got like the first third in the foreground full of just dozens of lit candles and then darkness in the back. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, with some isolated faces, maybe, I don't remember. And then Hannaford right in the middle, it's a slightly low angle. He looks like a monster. The way it's black and white, the way the shadows are just hitting the creases of his face. And then the reverse shot is in Peter Bogdanovich's glasses with just all of the, you know, dozens of little lights of the flames of the candles, and then the shot where he blows them out, and then we cut to Bogdanovich's sunglasses again. Just all those lights are extinguished. It's just stunning.
Black.
Stunning.
It's black.
Stunning.
I'm going to go on a tangent. I'm not going to respond.
That's fine.
To your query.
I'm just trying to keep this going.
I wonder, did Orson Welles see my What Did I Do Wrong Daddy's movies, John Cassavetes, because I feel a lot of kinship with faces and husbands in this movie. That's just men reveling in being men, but like with a critical eye to that, and that's not great. And like, there's such a raucous energy to, I forget what the guy's name in Faces is named, but in Husbands, it's John Cassavetes and Ben Gazzara.
That's my daddy.
And Peter Falk.
Oh, no. That's my daddy.
Found your daddy.
And it's just like these devastating portraits of men doing whatever the fuck they want. And that, like, the profound sadness in that.
In they're having a ball.
Mm-hmm. Yes. They're just, pummeling forward, hiding the feeling of sadness.
Yeah, it's like 5 a.m., the party's still going, mm-hmm. and everybody is at the end of a knockdown, drag-out fight. People mm-hmm. are still throwing punches, but everyone's all beat up and bleeding and moving like cavemen slowly, like their knuckles dragging. They're going mm-hmm. towards the ground, and they're still just trying to get in one more left hook,
mm-hmm.
which Hemingway's was overrated.
Yes, that's right. That's a good line, too.
Mm. I remember that line.
And I would like to now bring up my other daddy.
Mm. Oh, is this a pivot?
Just really quick, that Martin Scorsese has said for 40 years, his whole MO for his career was to combine Cassavetes and Orson Welles into one filmmaker, which I find very interesting, especially having seen this movie. Mm-hmm. I know, I'm like,
Interesting.
It, you know,
what,
you know what it is. Interesting.
It's very.
I think it's layered. I think it's dark.
I think it's rich.
I think it's I think it's rich. I think it's complicated. I think it's Frank Rich.
I think this
movie. Remember when we saw Peter Bogdanovich sitting in the back of the New Bev?
Oh my God! I saw him speak at the New Bev, but it wasn't that night. What movie was he seeing at the New Bev?
I think it was
last. What's the last picture show?
He was at his own, yeah.
Because he didn't speak that night.
He didn't stay for Texasville.
He left.
As a guest.
He left before Texasville.
Because he spoke
started.
At Targets. Because they played all of his movies.
They did, yeah.
But he did not speak at the last picture show.
No, unless he stayed through Texas. No, I stayed through
They would have done
it.
They and always do the Q&As in the middle.
I can report one Bogdanovich movie I've seen at the New Beverly Paper Moon. He was not there.
Yeah.
Although maybe he was sitting in the back.
Yeah, maybe he was just in the back. Hovering in the back.
Sure.
You never know.
He's you know,
sunglasses.
I think that this movie talks about the way that masculinity is a prison in the same way that Jean Dielman talks about how being a woman is a prison.
Well said. Mwah.
There, I made the reference. Are you happy?
I don't know if you just saw me, but I just mouthed. Thank you.
I did it.
I don't want to do it today.
Not today. That's the first time I've done it.
I too can command the other side of the wind, sir.
It's always you. Oh my God, Kate. I wonder if Kate saw this movie.
So I agree.
She would have seen it if it was at Cannes.
I agree with you. Do you think they would have played it in competition or in Cannes Classics?
I think it would have been in competition.
I think it would have been in competition too.
And I think it would have won the Palme d'Or.
I don't.
Is that possible? Because it's not technically I guess it is a
year
film.
It is. There's no other way to look at it. I mean, this is the year it finally was all put together and released.
It's true.
Okay. I think that if you, I mean, so I guess I've seen, I haven't seen Capernaum and I won't have seen it at AFI, but I've seen Black Klansman and I've seen Shoplifters. So one and two. And if that's the direction that the jury was going in, I can't see them veering towards this. Because Shoplifters and Black Klansman are such direct appeals to the heart.
Right.
Not that this isn't. I mean, I think this is a very emotionally affecting movie.
Well, the truth is, if Netflix was allowed to appear at Cannes,
Roma would have won the Palme d'Or.
Mm.
And I like Shoplifters a little bit more than Roma.
Oh, okay.
Shoplifter, in my top 10 list as of right now, Shoplifters is exactly one above Roma.
Mm-hmm.
And I also just love that Corrieta wins the Palme.
Yeah.
Roma probably would have won.
Yeah.
But I do love this winner.
I love this winner too.
I'm excited
both,
to see.
They're both in my
both
top 10.
I wanted to.
What am I like last three? I have to see like Roma, Shoplifters.
Fave.
All right.
There are a few movies.
There's a lot left.
I know. There's only 6 weeks of the year left and it feels like
There's some older movies I miss.
I know that Ben hated it, but Western is probably top of my list of movies that I missed from earlier this year.
I mean, it was top of my list of a movie to see.
For a while, I would only put like two movies on my watch list, and Western is now the oldest one on that list of like nine. But I need to check it out. So I want to talk about.
Give it a look.
We don't have to talk about it, but yes, the movie is about masculinity as a prison, but it also. It also is about friendship, and it's about betrayal. And there's two lines that I wrote down at the end. And I believe that Zara says both of these, and I think they're beautiful. So, one, with an old friend, it's quite enough to know he's there. And then she sort of undercuts it by saying, the bad thing is to find out a friendship was between a couple of other people.
Mm-hmm. I wrote that part down. I wrote it down myself. It's brutal.
What did I do wrong, Daddy?
I'm making a short film about that concept.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah, but nice. Maybe I'll tie it back to Billy here, who I think is the most devastating character in the movie. everyone knows that Billy is sober. Mm-hmm. No one is trying to, and not that, you know, at a certain level, it's, I don't need to jump into feelings on sobriety, but Jake eggs him on to like have that drink.
Yeah.
And by, he's like, he ran out of gumdrops, you know, or something like that. And Billy has been by his side since he was a child.
Right.
And has stuck around. And also on the flip side, it shows that Jake is actually has been a really loyal friend and that he continued to employ him. It reminds me of Robert Altman, like holding on to actors and giving them roles throughout their careers. Like mm-hmm. the fact that he kept Billy around, and once he was, you know, not a cute little kid anymore and couldn't have one of those small parts that he had in the old Hanover pictures, like he employs him as, he puts him on the payroll.
Right.
As some sort of producer, mm-hmm. second AD type thing.
Right.
And then after like what, 12 years of sobriety or whatever it is, Jake is on a fucking tear mm-hmm. and they're old friends, and his loyalty is more to raising hell and sowing mm-hmm. discord and division than protecting Billy.
Right.
And Billy is the last one at the drive-in. And he's just screaming about how, like, make your own movie or yeah. whatever. And that's one of the saddest part, like, one of the saddest images in the movie to me. Like, Billy seems to have everyone's best interests at heart, and yeah. he is done the most dirty by and everybody.
He's protecting yeah. Jake and with the film exec, the yes. studio exec, they, so hard.
They make him go and do it, exactly. Mm-hmm. Gumdrop?
He's got
the... I love when he's, yeah, when they're screening in the first part of the...
The film.
It's great. I want to, like... think of what his voice sounds like to do it.
Here's the movie if anyone wants to see it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Here it is.
I almost did his that voice in David like Lynch voice.
He's like, fireflies, I'll drink to that. Mm. And then later, one of the other characters who is like on the payroll shines mm-hmm. a flashlight at him and is like, look, Billy, fireflies. Like, they're just fucking with him. Mm-hmm. And he's the poor nicest, Billy. Sweetest boy. Yeah. So Stephen Yeun and Norman Foster are basically... one and two for my supporting actor of the year. And I had like said on Twitter that it was Norman Foster, but then I like Stephen Yeun is just like, that's just one of the greatest performances I've seen in a long time. And so is Norman Foster, yeah. but it's, they're doing very different things. Right. This is why we shouldn't compare performances, movies,
art.
Anything.
Art is uncomparable. It is.
Art is uncomparable.
Its own thing. Everything is its own thing.
What voice is that? That's
I don't know.
Don't be thick in front of me, Dale.
It almost devolved into how I think of French New Wave voiceovers. Je de bon. I don't know any French words. Je de bon. Je de bon. Je de bon.
Dans la piscine.
Je le nom. Je les aime.
Dans la rue.
Le mépris.
Oh my God.
Thank you. I've seen a lot of French New Wave movies in my day.
Very good.
Very good.
Thank you. Can we move on to homework?
Yes. Any other thoughts on The Other Side of the Wind?
I mean plenty, yes, plenty. But not right now.
Fine. So we will move on next to our
not
homework.
Not right now.
We'll move on to some homework here. So some unwieldy auteur pictures.
Wieldy auteur pictures.
Unwieldy auteur pictures. Unwieldy auteur pictures. The first film that we will discuss is Elaine May's Ishtar.
Can we talk about Apocalypse Now first?
Oh, sure. Fine. Fine.
I'm still grappling with Apocalypse Now because I watched it Jean this Moreau. Morning for the first time.
Oh, so yeah. What's your impression?
What the fuck?
How had I not seen it? Well, I'd seen like bits and pieces of it, but yeah. I'd never seen it from start to finish.
It's another movie about daddies.
It's just iconic.
It's iconic.
But like it is. It's like one of the best movies ever made. Yeah, I'm still like grappling with it. Fucks.
Sorry,
you, man.
I had to yawn after doing
it. Fuck.
And to yawn like Stephen Yeun.
Stephen Yeun.
Stephen Yeun.
Stephen Yeun. Oh my God.
Stephen Yeun!
That took you a minute.
Him yawning is the sexiest thing I've ever seen.
It's good.
I think that Apocalypse Now moves in a similar vein to Burning. Very different movies, but just since we're talking about Stephen Yeun and we're talking about Apocalypse Now, just that it as it moves on, the character is just journeying. Mm. Obviously, it's based on Heart of Darkness.
Into a heart
but
of
I
darkness.
Was going to bring up Conrad on when we were talking about Burning. Just
you did.
Oh, I did.
Just... a brief mention.
Oh, well, and then great. I already said it.
And it's very what homework? The Herzog that we what is
oh it? Yeah, Aguirre throughout the God. It is. I can see that too.
Aguirre is very. Aguirre came out after.
No,
really?
Aguirre would have been first.
77 for Aguirre.
I thought it was even earlier, but I could be wrong.
72.
I think it was like 72 or 73, I thought.
But yeah, just that. Just, and it's very like Lost City of Zed, obviously. Mm-hmm. I love a Journey into a Heart of Darkness movie.
Yeah. And this is the one.
It's the one.
This is the one. I think it is.
The singular one.
I think it is the most beautifully shot movie in the history of film.
Wow. It's insane.
I think it is.
Sure.
It's a movie that touches me in a deep place in my soul because it's about the emptiness of life.
Mm-hmm. And how obsession doesn't save you from that.
And how war is just totally insane. Mm-hmm. And
it is
pointless.
It is hell. The most true, honest portrayal.
It's just
the most damning portrayal of war.
Mm-hmm. Without, like, ever? It doesn't take a hard, like, point of view.
No, I mean,
it just shows.
Yeah,
and what happens.
And that's I feel similarly about Catherine Bigelow's The Hurt Locker, mm-hmm. just in that it's the idea of it not having a point of view. And it's like, well, look at the hell that these soldiers are going through. Look at the pressure that they're under as they're cutting these wires. Like, the filmmaker isn't, you couldn't say that she's shooting this as if to suggest what a fun time. Like, it's hell. And Apocalypse Now obviously pioneers that concept.
Mm-hmm. It's just,
I mean, Days of, or Paths of Glory, you could also say.
But.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
It's hard to talk about Apocalypse Now in the year of our Lord 2018 because so much has already been said about Apocalypse
Now. Right. I mean, I could talk about the sound design of the fan blades being the chopper blades. We could talk about that. We could, mm-hmm. what is it, Pink Floyd with the smashing of the fist into the mirror? We could talk about that. We could talk. We could talk about how
and
that
the use
was
of the doors.
Yes,
and
of course.
The way and that he had to blow up the village. He was not allowed to leave the village when they stopped shooting, and that's what the blowing up is in the movie.
Wait, what was that?
The enclave where they find Marlon Brando was built for the movie, and they told him you have to destroy it before you leave. You can't leave that here.
Mm.
So it's blown up.
And so he did.
So he blew it up.
And the rest is film history.
Wow.
And like all of it is like myth making on a Jake Hannaford level. Like he was like, this is going to be the first movie that wins the Nobel Prize. Like this isn't a movie about war. This movie is war. Like all of that shit. That
and the
he
production
did.
History reflects that as well.
Mm-hmm. And it's just like, I read Roger Ebert's review right before y'all came over. His original review, he also has a great movie, his essay about it, but his original review opens with this Francois Truffaut quote that Francois Truffaut originally said, a good movie or great movie has something to say about the world and something to say about filmmaking. And then he later would take that back and said, I'm only interested in movies that show either the ecstatic joy of filmmaking or the absolute hell of filmmaking, and I don't want anything in between. And I think Apocalypse Now shows both.
I think The Other Side of the Wind also
the
shows
the joy both. And the hell of filmmaking.
Yeah, so I didn't rewatch it for the podcast, and I haven't seen it in many years, and I have no regrets. I couldn't make it work, but I wish that I had been able to. But there is something.
Everyone's hot in that movie.
Everyone is very hot. There's something about the contrast between just the beautifully realized scope of the film and the images themselves.
It's pristine.
Exactly. They're delectable, they're textured, and they're pristine, and they cause some sort of emotional and intellectual rupture in you depending on the scene. Well, at the same time, what it's depicting is so brutal that there's a bit of a dissonance involved between the beauty of the images and the real human horror and destruction going on. I mean, in the Ride of the Valkyrie scene, mm-hmm. the first shot of the film, even with the bombs going yeah. off against the trees, like the way, I mean, just to, this is of course not the first movie nor the right movie you should talk about, but like if you think about it, Burning, that intense close up of the burning greenhouse, and mm-hmm. it's stunning and it's gorgeous, but it is about destruction and yeah. decay and corruption. And the first shot in Apocalypse Now works on a similar wavelength. Just the epic scope of it is
impressive. And there's also
so
something to be said
impressive.
About the exploitative nature of filmmaking.
That's where I was going to go from here. And the same goes for The Ride of the Valkyries dropping yeah. those bombs.
It's like, obviously...
That actually happened.
Obviously, the Vietnam War did more damage than this movie did, but this movie did damage to the Earth, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it's not CG, and that's mm-hmm. that makes it so literally marvelous.
Yeah.
But the fact, I mean, it's somewhat problematic, but
yeah.
it's certainly complicated. But having to reckon, and it's partly probably why the film has such a visceral impact on you, is that you are watching the destruction of war as it's happening on screen. It's not a documentary, but if you talk about what documentary is in terms of capturing something that's happening, there's a million different definitions of documentary, right? Mm-hmm. But Coppola put a camera down and blew up a fucking jungle.
Right.
That jungle's not there anymore. Right. Like that, yeah. So that does add this documentary element to it, and not that it's a hybrid, just that it talks about, it's just like, and this is actually mentioned in The Other Side of the Wind, just like the camera as like truth teller, right? Mm-hmm.
And the old adage that... every movie is a documentary of its own making. Like yeah. you're literally shooting what you shoot. Therefore, it's a documentary in that.
Right.
In
and it's
a way.
Something that's so wonderful about The Other Side of the Wind, because especially with What Did I Do Wrong, Daddy? Mm-hmm. Like the way clearly Bogdanovich is working out some of his own daddy issues with Wells in these scenes, and in that way, it feels like a behind the scenes portrait yeah. of several real life people.
Yeah.
While also having a dramatic purpose within the narrative of the yeah. film.
This is very tangential, but in that Tamara Jenkins podcast I was listening to, mm-hmm. Her husband attributes a quote I have loved for a long time to Francis Ford Coppola.
Good movie.
I never knew that. What?
What's the quote?
Your movie will never be as good as the dailies or as bad as the first cut.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
I didn't know that was him. That is apparently him.
Hmm.
Apocryphally.
I remember him saying that.
Should write that down. Write it down. Someone should write that down.
That was the film. No, the Lincoln Center.
Yeah, the close-up.
The close-up, yeah. Mm-hmm.
That was on the close-up, if you'd like to listen. Lincoln Center, please Venmo us $42. Thank you.
They can't afford it.
I know.
Just give us free issues of Film Comment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've already subscribed for like the next 5 years. Like I have like the longest...
You're locked in.
Subscription option that they offer.
Because it's the cheapest.
Yeah.
Hell yeah.
Hell yeah.
Hell yeah.
Hell yeah, fuck yeah.
Fuck yeah, hell yeah.
Robert Duvall,
Film
hot
comments,
and scary.
Please send me a full catalog of all 50 years, every issue. Thank you. That's what I want instead of...
I think that's fair. I think that's
You're not going to sell those.
Humble request. Yeah, I think it's...
Totally.
In a way, you're building a new library. This is you are justifying this by preserving film history.
Oh, I just
further.
Need the kindling
for the future. For the future fires.
Yeah.
During the water wars.
Yeah.
For the impending water.
For when
wars.
We need to boil our water.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything to talk about here, in comparing Kurtz and Hannaford?
I mean, yes.
Yeah.
Oh.
I think there's plenty. I think it's a question of whether we want to.
We
have to start doing this podcast in the middle of the afternoon.
Sweaty face. That's my Marlon Brando impression. Marlon Brando showed up in Cambodia, and Francis Ford Coppola was like, okay. And Marlon was like, I haven't read the script or the book,
but I'm here.
What are we doing?
But I'm here.
What's this movie about?
I love that story.
Give me the money.
I've never watched the documentary about it.
Hearts of Darkness.
I've never watched Hearts of Darkness.
I love Hearts of Darkness. It's good.
I'd like to watch it.
It is good.
And it's directed by Mrs. Coppola, right? Yeah.
Eleanor, who just directed her first.
That's right.
Actual non-documentary.
And who
was
in that film?
Diane Lane.
Oh, that's right.
I wanted to say Patricia Clarkson.
Paris Can Wait.
It's called I'm going to Paris.
Yeah. It's called Leave Her to Heaven.
Yeah. Something like that. Starring Diane Lane.
Did you guys see Destination Wedding, by the way?
No.
No, isn't it VOD?
We'll talk about it another time.
Mm. You've seen it?
I watched about 40 minutes of it I was in New York at 2 in the morning drunk with my friend's girlfriend's sister.
Nice. How was that?
We turned it off prematurely.
Ooh, it's not good.
Seems like a good plane movie, but no. You think if you watched it on a plane? I know, but do you think if you would have
It's seriously grating. I mean, it's a great idea.
What's it called? The Wedding?
Destination Wedding.
That's right.
It's trying to both combine, like, Beckett and a screwball comedy and a romantic comedy.
Diane Wiest doing Beckett.
Oh.
We never talked about that on the pod.
We didn't talk about it. It was as terrifying and absurd
Speaking
as Beckett is.
Speaking of unwieldy auteur pictures.
That
Diane
is one
Wiest
of them.
In a rock in
doing
the park.
Beckett.
That is unwieldy.
It was dark. It was layered. It was interesting.
I love that.
I mean, she is such an expressive actor.
Yeah.
And like I just said, she captures the tone of Beckett, which is absurd.
Mm-hmm.
And bone-chilling.
Yeah.
And you know, I missed the first 15 minutes or whatever, and it's not as if there would have been such an easy narrative or whatever to follow in the monologue, but she forces you to be on her wavelength, something that we say on here sometimes.
Something like, I gotta lean in a little.
Yeah. You know, in the hands of a lesser rock, I can't say... if it would have been as affecting, as commanding, in the hands of a lesser boulder.
I do command this rock.
Two-time Academy Award-winning rock, Diane Wiest.
Yes. Diane Wiest is a rock. The rest of us are just pebbles.
Imagine if her two Oscar-winning roles were as rocks.
Diane Wiest, actress, rock.
Hannah and her sisters. One of the
a rock a caterer. Rock. A caterer rock. A jealous rock of Carrie Fisher.
Carrie Fisher
cuts
rock.
To her reverse shot as a rock on the other side of the street. Just cars are passing by. She's just like frowning. Womp womp. And then a famous stage
good.
Rock.
That's so good. Oh my God.
Diane Wiest, rock.
Don't speak.
Don't speak. As a rock.
As a rock, yeah. Don't she's like someone's holding her like this is so dumb. I'm sorry. Someone's like holding her as the rock, like next to a body of water. She's like, don't skip, as in me. Let's talk about Ishtar.
Yeah,
Ishtar.
All right, so now we're talking about Lin-May's Ishtar. So we all
Ishtar is one of the most fun first 20 minutes.
Yes, I'm loving it.
And then
the first 15 minutes. Are good.
You're like, oh, this isn't going to be the disaster that I thought it was.
Yep. And then the rest of the movie happens.
I disagree. I mean, I don't think it's a disaster. I think that what...
I don't think it's a disaster. I mean, I give it
I think what is
half.
I think what is clunky about it is what is most interesting about it, which is the way that it is talking about American interference in foreign governments, toppling left-leaning insurgent parties.
Yeah.
And the great shot that I tweeted of Chuck Grodin... on the phone with the picture of Reagan in the background, it is absolutely damning about 80s foreign policy.
Yeah.
Of course, this is where the movie sort of loses its plot, in my opinion. But I do think those are the most interesting strands.
Yeah.
But I tell you what, I know I found out today that folks think that Warren Beatty and Dustin Hoffman are miscast. I think it is brilliant stunt casting.
I think it's great.
I love watching them just be two fucking idiots, and it's Dumb and Dumber. It's great.
I think this is... I love Dustin Hoffman a lot. And...
Oop.
But here comes a but.
Woo!
I like Warren Beatty in this movie, is all I will say.
Warren Beatty is the best part about the movie.
Warren Beatty is amazing in this movie, and he like allows himself to be ugly and a doofus and
so funny.
Sad and schlubby. Mm. I mean, he still has the body. Warren Beatty never lost the body.
Yeah, when Warren Beatty's like, when Warren Beatty is like, yeah, women just don't like me. It's like, okay, buddy.
It's like, all right.
But I think that Elaine May is working off, and Warren Beatty, for them, that are both working off that star persona. I mean, obviously, they both had a terrible time making the movie. It's not like they were simpatico and everything, but I think it's great casting, like anti-casting on that level. There's a gag that I love in the movie. The first song that they're writing about telling the truth can be dangerous business. For me, the joke is that business is extra syllables, and the word that they're looking for is work. That it can be dangerous work.
Oh, that's funny.
But they just stick with it?
Yeah. They keep with
they
business.
They just keep going?
Because like, it's one syllable too long. Business.
It's genius. You're such a genius.
You're such a talent. You're such a talent.
And when Carol Kane in that first scene is just so fucking bored.
Move in with me. I'm doing Julie Kavner.
Carol Kane.
Move in with me.
And then it's just like, once we get to Morocco, we are off to the races with just like, what the fuck is this movie? Isabella Adjani, and they think she's a boy.
I couldn't.
Like, where'd these boobs come from?
And he keeps grabbing her boobs.
Yeah, I don't care for that.
And they're just like,
oh, I really don't care for that, especially.
They're just like, what? Boob. Boob.
The whole rest of the movie is just boob.
But there's something. God, I've been trying to think of it since I watched the movie this afternoon, and I guess I'm just not going to get it. But there's another movie it reminds me of Citizen Ruth. And
I've never seen
it. So that. Something to know about Citizen Ruth. I mean, you know what it's about, of course. So Laura Dern is this. Woman living on the skid marks of society. She's into like huffing glue. She gets pregnant and she is caught between the pro-life and pro-choice movements, both of whom are in ways that echo the story of Roe v. Wade.
Yeah.
Like both sides are manipulating her in order to get her to be their mouthpiece. Mm-hmm. And there's just something about much funnier in Ishtar. I mean, Citizen Ruth is funny, but it's a pretty dark film. Just the way that the CIA and then this leftist radical organization are willfully manipulating Warren Beatty and Dustin Hoffman's characters just in order to use them as agents is very funny to me, and sort of its own scathing critique about 80s U.S. foreign policy.
It's the Americans. It's just the Americans. The I was TV thinking, show.
Yeah, it's, like it, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Quality-wise and everything. It's just the same.
I would say, I mean, I really enjoyed the film. There were stretches where I wasn't going along with it, but I pretty consistently liked it. I'm not going to... I just want to make clear to anyone who might be listening to this, I am not in misunderstood masterpiece camp. I think that it's a flawed movie. I think that it's... I don't think it's an out-and-out failure, but I think a lot of what... Like I was saying, the clunkiest moments, I think, are its smartest moments. So it's frustrating that they're clunky in the first place. That's where this movie should really sing.
Yeah.
But I do love the first 20 minutes.
Yeah, and it is just like there are long stretches where it's just that I'm bored. Like
me too.
Like long stretches once they're... Like the first like 15 minutes in Morocco, I'm all in still. And then it just gets boring.
I feel the same way.
It I just like a camel.
Oh, like the blind camel is just a classic.
Camel's
gag.
Good. I do love
watch
when
out for
he
his tooth.
Isabella Gnani is a boy for a minute and he's like, I'm sorry, it's not my lifestyle. Like it's okay.
And then she, not that there's anything wrong with that.
Flashes him.
Flashes her tits.
It's like, oh.
Singular tit.
Yeah, you're right. It was just the one. Just the one.
Just the singular.
Yeah, I like the first 15 minutes of this
and
movie.
And he's like, well, look at that.
I love the first 15 minutes of this movie. I love the last 15 minutes of this movie. Mm-hmm. I think it is such
I don't even remember the last 15 because I was banging my head on that table.
Wow, you hated it.
Yeah, I hated this
movie.
You were
doing Hereditary.
So what, yes. What did you hate about it?
I hated it. I don't know. I can't describe why. I hated them. I hated...
I mean, that's a lot of people watching this movie.
I hated the plot. I hated it. I just... What was
Roger Ebert? I hated it.
Yeah,
I hate this movie.
I hate this movie. I liked the first 15 minutes. I thought, oh, this won't be bad, and then it fell off a cliff for me, and it never got me back. The whole movie. By the end, I was so happy it was over.
Yeah,
that's it's how just, I felt. I was in pain.
I think I'm if sorry. I wasn't such an Elaine May fan, where I know the rhythm of her jokes so well that just like that alone is comforting to me.
Sure.
That even though it's not the Heartbreak Kid, I'm still going to get some chuckles out of it.
Sure.
I'm not even such an Elaine May fan because I'm more familiar with her screenwriting than I mean, this is my first
directorial.
This is the first movie I've ever seen directed by Elaine May.
Well, guess what? It can only go up.
Sure,
from
absolutely.
It is a bummer that like she never directed a movie after this.
Yeah.
This like ruined her.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And
which
I
is really
I don't
sad.
Think that this movie is any worse than any mediocre studio comedy.
Right.
Of course.
And I think it has much
really
bigger
sad.
Ideas than any of those movies.
Yeah. Totally. Yeah. It just
and the jokes that are there are funnier.
And
than
you
a lot
you
of them.
And it's challenging. I mean, those to you know, Brandon hates these two lead characters. They're kind of hard to stick around with unless you get on their level.
Yeah. Yeah, get that, on that level, the, Brandon.
The history of this being such a failure is a bummer because, you know, she never came back from
it. Yeah.
She did get Oscar nominations for writing afterwards, but yeah, she
right,
didn't direct directing, the movie.
She never, yeah.
I,
she never, they never took another chance. And I mean, right. even It was 11 years since she made Mikey and Nikki. Because that didn't make any money. So it's like she struggled directing her entire career. Not even just post-Ishtar. But it was like Ishtar was the last chance. Mm-hmm. Someone threw her a bone. And then if it was a man,
it would have directed again.
It would have just been like, okay, you take like 3 years off and then you come back to it. Whatever. Hollywood.
I think it's a
misogyny.
I think it's a good movie.
Good movie.
I think it's a big mixed bag, but like I was saying, like the stretches that I find most boring, I also find kind of interesting. I find them dark, I find them complicated, I find them layered.
That's how I feel about Heaven's Gate. It's boring, but there are some interesting ideas.
Again, I can't believe I love Isabella Gianni, but I'm not pitting women against women. This is a legendary French feud, right? Between a Gianni and a Huppert. And we fell on the side of Possession.
Here we did.
We fell on the side of Adele. Oops. Did I tell you guys about the time that, I know I told you guys about this, I don't know if I've mentioned on the microphone, but I was on a radio show with a director of programming at Outfest to plug the festival earlier this summer, like some local LA, it was actually, I think it's the oldest or the longest running gay radio show in Los Angeles.
Aww.
And I mentioned that our international centerpiece starred Isabelle Huppert, who is maybe my favorite actress. And one of the hosts went off on a tear. He was like, oh, I love her so much. She's great. I've admired her for so long. Oh my God. And Adele H, she was so extraordinary. Oh. And I just sat there being like, am I going to say something? And then I decided to, and of course, knowing me, my tone did not come across. But I was like, you're actually thinking of Isabella Gianni? This is Isabelle Huppert, and that's quite a mistake to make.
Oh.
Or something like that. On air. Oops. I have problems with my tone. I meant it nicely, but I don't think we were friends for the rest of the show.
Oh, oops.
I meant it nicely. I meant it as a joke.
Maybe he's listening and can apologize.
I hope that he is.
You.
Please have
can
us
you
on.
Ever forgive Daniel?
Tell us and write us an iTunes review.
Daniel, write us a forged Dorothy Parker letter and let us know if you can forgive Daniel.
I don't have to forge it. I'll write it myself. The answer is no.
Oh, fuck.
The answer is no.
It's dark. You're deserving of love.
That's dark. That's right. Rich. That's interesting.
Let's wrap it up.
Okay. Well, you're not in charge, but maybe we should.
Let's wrap it up.
Okay. Hold on. You're not in charge. Maybe we should wrap it up. What do you think?
Daddy.
Should we wrap it up?
But Daddy.
All right, this has been another episode of Movies IMO. Thrilled that you tuned in. Thrilled that you chilled out. Thrilled to have you on the program. We are... Nope, I'm doing it wrong. No, next week. Nope, my name's Daniel Crook.
You do it in any order you want.
But we've been doing this for a while, and I'll never learn.
Every time.
My name's Daniel Crook. You can find me on the internet at Daniel Crook with 3 O's. And I don't have an extra thing to say today. I just love The Other Side of the Wind.
We love it.
I want to watch it a third time.
Mm.
I hope that we had talked about it at all. Like it's because here's the thing. Like it's a rich piece of work. It's layered. It's complicated. It's dark. It's interesting. But I actually, especially after a second time through, I don't find it that hard to follow. Like, it's more that the idea...
I didn't find it hard the first time.
Yeah, I didn't really either after the first, like, 20 minutes and I was...
It takes a minute.
Like,
it's crazy.
Well, I love, like...
Oh, it's impossible to follow.
The first half is so much noise and the back half is a lot of signal. Like, which I love about it. Like, it situates you in the fury of the storm and then it's not that the storm subsides, but it wrecks havoc and then it leads to sort of a more... silent melancholy destruction. Look for that on my top 10 list.
Hell yeah. I'm Brandon Kirby. You can find me on Twitter at BK Kirby.
I'm Ben MP. You can find me on Twitter. Twitter at Real Todd Haynes.
Next week we are talking about...
What are we talking about?
We are talking about Steve McQueen's...
Oh, hell yeah.
Long-awaited follow-up to Best Picture winner 12 Years a Slave. I love McQueen. I'm very excited to see him mesh sensibilities with Gillian Flynn in Widows. Talking about Widows.
Widows. Widows. Starring Viola Davis.
And Cynthia Erivo.
And Elizabeth
Debicki.
Debicki.
Should have gotten an Emmy nomination for The Night Manager.
Yeah, I loved her in The Night Manager.
So great in The Night Manager.
I did not like The Night Manager.
But I liked The Night Manager fine.
I loved her in it.
The Night Manager just like moved along.
Remember when Tom Hiddleston accepted his Golden Globe and was
children
like...
Children in Africa love watching the
Children
Night
in
Manager.
Africa love The Night Manager.
Okay, I don't remember that.
He literally was like, they just all come up to me and tell me how much they love The Night. It's so bad.
I think Hugh Laurie is good in The Night Manager. I also think
yeah, he is.
But here's the thing, the two best
performers. Isn't Olivia Colman in that?
Yes, and she did get the nomination.
Susanna Beer's new film, Bird Box, coming soon.
Did you end up? No, you didn't end up seeing it.
Because it was a gala, and I was like, I'm not going to
So go. Olivia Colman gives the best performance in The Night Manager, mm-hmm. followed by Elizabeth Debicki, and then followed by Tom Hollander.
The other Tommy. Yeah.
Those are the three best performances in The Night Manager.
Nice.
Next week, we'll be talking about Suzanne Beer's The Night Manager. And nice. All six parts.
From what, 2016? How long ago was that now?
2016.
Yeah, 16.
Yeah. I actually, you know what? I like The Night Manager. Okay. I'm not going to, like, I want to be cool like and say that Citizen Kane is overrated. Like, I want to be cool and say that The Night Manager is just for boys. But fuck it. No, I fucking loved The Night Manager.
You know what? I watched it.
It was just fun.
I find it boring. I
do
find
it boring. It's John Le Carré. It's boring in a fun way.
Well. Something in the same vein is Patrick Melrose, which I watched.
Oh, did you watch it?
I watched.
That show doesn't exist.
I watched two episodes, and you know what, Ben? You should tune in.
Oh!
You would love it. You would love it.
When the
it's actually quite good.
Yeah, when the billboards for Patrick Melrose went around town where it's just a Mad Men ripoff, mm-hmm. Benedict Cumberbatch sitting in an overflowing bathtub with a tumbler of scotch, and I just wanted to make fun of it, and then I found out sort of what it's about. It's no laughing matter.
Oh, it's no laughing matter. It's based on these series of novels, right. British, and I hate looking at Cumberbatch's face, but it's like the best thing he's ever done, probably. IMO.
That wouldn't shock me. That's not a high bar, you know?
Right.
I remember thinking he was so astonishingly good in Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy.
I've never seen that.
And being like, this is the guy to watch.
Yeah.
This is our guy.
I think everyone felt that way.
And then I just...
As noted by the next 4 years of roles.
And then I just don't really like him in anything else.
He really thinks he deserves an Oscar.
And you know what? Maybe he's a nice guy.
Yeah.
Maybe he has a lot of fans in Africa as well. Who knows? But... I'm not a big fan of his acting. Yes, we're talking about Widows next week. We're going to also talk about Michael Mann's Heat.
Heat.
So that's a little hat tip to all the Michael men out there. Heat. And we're also talking about Jules Dassin. Yeah, Jules Dassin. Oh, fuck. I love Jules Dassin.
Réfifi. I will be able to do this voice a lot next week.
Great.
We're doing
well,
French.
Jules Dassin's not French.
Doing French.
He's not French.
Isn't the movie French?
I think the movie's French, but Jules Dassin is not French.
Where is he from?
He's American.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Let me just double check because I don't want to have
he's
you cut this out.
He's an American film director, producer, writer, and actor.
Yeah, he's got that French name, but Jules Dassin is American. And if you have never seen... I mean, The Naked City is great, but the one that I really love, which I am having to look up the name of, which is embarrassing, Night in the City. Love Night in the City so much.
A long time ago in a galaxy.
Yeah, Richard Widmark in that movie is just the slimiest, most desperate baby. So we're talking about Widows, talking about Heat, and we're talking about Réfifi. You can find Movies IMO on Twitter.
On Twitter.
At Movies IMO.
At Movies IMO.
Please.
S'il vous plaît. S'il vous plaît. That's, I was like, no. S'il vous plaît. S'il vous plaît.
Please write.
Escribir.
Escribir.
Now I'm doing Spanish.
Please write us a review on the iTunes store. Please write us 5 stars and answer the question, what's your favorite side of the wind?
Yes.
Yeah.
Tell us.
Tell us. What's your favorite side of the wind?
Who's your daddy?
Oh, that's better.
Tell us. What did you do wrong, daddy?
Well, no, what did you do wrong to your daddy?
Yeah. What did you do wrong to daddy?
Don't wake daddy.
Don't wake daddy. Final thought on other side of the
Where's the Hasbro tie-in?
Give us $1 million. Hasbro can afford it.
I just want to mention that at the end of The Other Side of the Wind, when Jake drives off the property, we linger on a cactus that looks like it's giving you the middle finger.
Mm.
Nice. Mm-hmm.
To match the enormous
The phallus.
The pink dick.
In the film.
That knocks over. That is knocked over by the wind.
Oh, God. The big dick in this movie.
This movie had... I think it's over, but like...
Big dick energy.
The movie has big dick energy and a lot of small dick energy and a lot of curved dick energy. Oh. And I want you to just like fade this out as... Anything else?
And no dick energy.
Say something in French.
Wait, hold on. Can I say something? And then can I say something in English and then you'll say it in French?
Sure.
I'm finished.
I'm finished.
The winner is Jane Fonda.
Thank you. Thank you very much, members of the Academy, and thank all of you who applauded. There's a great deal to say, and I'm not going to say it tonight. I would just like to really thank you very much.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com